I hereby introduce to you, Mr. Michael Veazey.
So I'm here with CJ Rosenbaum from Amazon Sellers Lawyer, and he's whipping through a bunch of thorny legal issues, which is way, way overdue that we had an expert addressed. So this time we're going to do a Q&A on some of the questions that are coming from listeners. So if you're listening or watching and you didn't respond to my email, more for you, you are getting a lawyer's advice for free. This is a historic occasion. So, you know, next time respond to the email, guys. But anyway, I've got about 8 questions to get through. So the first one is about so-called generic designs of clothes or jewellery. And I happen to know this person has had a lot of issues in the jewellery sector. I keep hearing this term, but after researching into it, I seem to find this doesn't exist. For example, at some point in time, a piece of jewellery must have been designed by somebody. Are they ever just kind of given to the public, like open source software? And is there a database where I can check jewellery copyrights? Quite a detailed question.
Okay. Let's break it down. You can absolutely do a search. You can try it yourself. Again, I'm not familiar with the UK system, but United States, you go to the United States Patent and Trademark Office website, uspto.org, and they have a kind of an archaic search engine that you can use to try and find patented products when it comes to anything at all. If you're not real skilled or you don't have a lot of patience, then you can hire someone to do a search. Many designs are going to have been filed for protection, and many will not. It could also be that you start selling a product that someone has already been selling for a number of years. And since the United States is a first to use rather than a first to file country, you may still have some problems. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean you don't want to get into that product. I mean, just like you said, it's all risk versus reward. If you think that you can make a couple of hundred thousand pounds in a relatively short period of time with a fairly insignificant risk, there might be a good business decision to do that. Other people might decide against taking that risk. So it really is a product by product and a profit by profit analysis as to what you're comfortable doing in terms of taking a risk with a certain product.
Great, thank you. Now there's one sort of follow-up part to this question, if I understand it. He says, does design copyright just run out and then factories in China just turn out thousands of replicas? Does it work that way?
There are certain IP rights that expire. They become part of the public domain, and it really depends on how they're filed. There are certain designs that are used that have what's called trade dress, D-R-E-S-S, and that does not expire. So again, I hate to not answer the question, okay? I don't want to fall in this trap that, oh my God, this lawyer is not answering the question. But in generalities, it really can't be answered. The best thing would be to look at the product that you're looking at your investment, and if it costs another, you know, $300 to $500 to get an opinion on that particular product, you decide as a business person whether it's worthwhile to pay that, or just make yourself savvy yourself at checking the listings and seeing what you think the risks are.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that having used the uspto.org site myself, it seems pretty straightforward to use. As you say, it kind of feels like 1997, but it's a bit archaic, but it seems straightforward. So if you think that's a good place to start as well, then that's reassuring. And yeah, as you say, if you're going to invest quite a lot of money, it's worth paying a few hundred dollars to a lawyer to reassure yourself. And if you're going to just spend $5,000, you maybe it isn't. So, okay, that makes sense. Next question.
I've been dying to address the comments on fees. Everyone is afraid of attorney's fees.
Yep.
These things do not cost a ton of money. You can get a lot of great protection, a lot of great information for a relatively small amount of money in most of the issues that Amazon sellers face. Not all of them, but most. So it doesn't hurt to call. We don't charge to talk to you, you know. And then you could find out and make the decisions yourself, but you're generally not facing exorbitant legal fees.
So just to clarify, we're not, because everyone has this idea, which includes me, and maybe I should know better, but that you pick up the phone to a lawyer's office, you start the meter's running, but that's not exactly how it works then.
No, in fact, what we do is we try and provide every client with a flat fee so you know exactly what you're going to pay. Nobody can guarantee success, okay, really in any issue. But at least you'll know what you're going to pay, what it's going to cost you, how long it's going to take for us to get you your plan of action, okay? So you can make a business decision whether you want to proceed or you don't want to proceed. And we try and do that across the board with all of our projects. We give the clients the opportunity to say, okay, this is my flat fee for this project.
Great, that makes a lot of sense. And then you can put it into your overall profit loss projections and make, as you say, a business-like decision rather than having something hanging over. Well, thank you. That is worth addressing. That's definitely worth addressing. I mean, whether it works the same in the UK, I wouldn't like to say. So just a legal caveat there. Not sure it's the same, but, you know, at least it exists in the US. And to be honest, especially if you're based in London, as I am, and I know a number of people listening will be, what happens in the US tends to get copied in London sooner or later anyway. It's just one of those rules of the culture somehow. So I imagine that there will be that option as well. So moving to our next question, Lorraine's got a question about the liability side. Who is legally responsible if, in the worst case, for example, somebody dies from using my private label product? So presumably we're talking about things you consume, like supplements, food, that kind of thing. Quite a scary question. Over to you.
My experience, you know, I did a ton of trials as a trial lawyer for personal injury and medical malpractice and employment cases for many, many years. And whether you're responsible for or not, if someone gets terribly hurt and you touch that product, you're going to get sued. Okay? If someone is hurt enough or someone died who is earning enough money that it's worthwhile to the lawyer, you're going to be part of the defendants. If it's your design, you're going to have responsibility. If you sold it, you're going to have responsibility. If you were a middleman, you're going to have some responsibility for that product. But then the product actually has to hurt somebody, and the injuries have to be enough that it's worthwhile for a lawyer to accept. And the lawyers will often take cases that have fairly minimal damages, you know, if someone didn't get that hurt, terribly hurt, and they'll still reach out to you and try and resolve the case if you were threatened litigation or even file a lawsuit, which is why the product liability insurance could be important. But anyone involved under U.S. law, anyone in the entire chain of distribution from design until that person is hurt, has potential liability for those injuries.
Okay, that's very interesting. Well, I think that that answers quite a few of the other questions that you this question was saying. Is it me or the manufacturer? And according to you, it's both. And what kind of insurance do I need to cover all eventualities? I guess it's the product liability insurance.
Yeah, you should have a general liability, which should have a product liability component to it. And that should cover it. And one of the other huge benefits of having insurance is that when a lawyer gets that case and he represents an injured person and there's insurance involved, it makes settlement a lot. There's $1 million in insurance coverage and they'll be likely to settle within that $1 million. And the insurance company wants to settle it so they don't have to pay the defense costs. If you have a seller without insurance, there's nothing that sets the parameters for the case. So that's another benefit you get by having liability coverage.
Okay, so that makes even more sense to have liability cover. Yeah, so it's basically going to be easier for the other side's lawyers to reach out and just settle with the insurance company without going to court because it saves them a ton of time and
money. Yes, it also brings professionals on board who deal with claims like that day in and day out. So they know how to settle cases. They know how to resolve issues where, you know, sellers know how to sell. You know how to pick products or have products made for you and run your dashboard and, you know, watch the register and you do what you do very, very well. If you have a problem like that, you want a claims representative or a defense lawyer who knows how to handle those issues. You know, we all know our little part of commerce. And so if you have that issue, you really want someone to handle it who knows what they're doing.
Yep, that totally makes sense. Absolutely. If somebody's died or was injured, you don't want amateurs in the game. So another question that is part of this question, which has quite a lot of parts now I look at it, are there any international implications as a UK seller selling in the US with a US manufacturer? Now, there's a specific question.
You know, I don't see any differences in the potential liability or the potential profitability of the relationship. You know, in this day and age, I don't think crossing international lines is really going to mean all that much. Each seller is going to have their own tax implications, you know, here and at home. But in terms of either increasing or decreasing liability, not really. Same. I think it's about the same.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's a safe starting point anyway as well, isn't it? If it turns out you can get out of jail free, great, but it's not a safe starting point. A question that I think in a sense you probably already answered by saying everyone in the chain, in the retail, in the supply chain, I guess, is to some extent on the hook. From Julianne saying, as a retail arbitrage or online arbitrage seller, do we have legal liability for what happens to the customer? Just for those who don't know what those terms are, that just basically means if you go to Tesco or Walmart, buy whatever you can buy for $5 a unit or £5 a unit and sell it for $20 or £20, whatever, on Amazon. So you're not private labeling, it's not your design, you're not even wholesaling. Do you still have any form of liability if something goes wrong with that product?
Your ultimate liability for the person who was hurt is probably very, very minimal, as long as you didn't change the product in any way or sell the product for a different use. However, you're still going to get brought into that lawsuit and you're still going to have to defend yourself, which is, again, why insurance could be important. Because it will take some time to work your way through the system before you even get the opportunity to ask the court or the judge to let you out of the case. You know, especially here in New York, you would get sued. You have to answer that lawsuit. You have to attend a couple of court conferences. There are going to be what's called depositions, where the lawyers get to ask all sorts of questions. There's going to be documentary discovery, where paperwork and documents go back and forth. And it's only after all of that goes on, do you really have a good chance of a judge letting you out of the case? And by that time, your defense costs alone could be, you know, $20,000,
$30,000, $40,000. Right. Okay. Well, that's a very sobering. And again, if you were selling insurance, you'd be a rich man by now. I think you're making an exceptionally good case. We must, we've got Ashlyn to talk to you about that. I think that's it's becoming more and more, you know, two sides of the same coin, really. But which is kind of obvious, but again, you've connected the dots up. I wouldn't have seen that. But one other thing that strikes me, and this may be an impossible thing for you to answer as an American lawyer dealing mostly, presumably, with American clients, but would, if my company got sued and it happened to be a UK-based company, would I have to go over to New York several times to go and appear before the courts there?
Yes. Not as often as you might think. And again, the lawsuits over the products are really kind of few and far between. But yes, if you were sued, if you're like a one-man show, then you'd have to come in at least for what's called your deposition, this question and answer thing. And you would probably want to come in if there was a trial. But that's really about it. The lawyers go to the conferences without the clients. You appear before the judge, you make the arguments and the paperwork. You don't really need to come in. So if you were one of the unfortunate souls whose product hurt somebody and you were sued, and you couldn't resolve it, and the case goes all the way through the system, you'd probably have to come in probably twice.
Okay. Well, there are better reasons for a trip to New York, but I guess it could be worse. It depends where you end up getting sued. Let's just hope we don't get sued in Utah or Ohio or somewhere dull like that. Anyway, I shouldn't say that. Forgive me if you're from Ohio. I've never been. I shouldn't even say that. Okay, moving on to the next question swiftly. You said before you offend half the US. Helena says, what protection? Well, we kind of talked about this in the other episode, but just briefly remind us, what protection does a UK limited liability company give a UK-based seller who sells on Amazon.com? Is the director of a limited liability company open to personal liability when selling on Amazon.com?
Okay. I'm not a UK barrister, at least not yet. I hope to be within about another 12 months, but so far. So the honest answer is I don't know, but I suspect that you would have the same protections that a US-based corporation or LLC would have, where your liability is limited to the extent of the value of that corporation, where it wouldn't come and touch you. There are certain situations, at least in the US, where they call it piercing the corporate veil or director liability, but that requires some really, really bad conduct, you know, really almost knowingly putting something out there to hurt somebody. And even then, it's very difficult to get through to somebody's personal assets.
Just a tiny bit on that. I mean, obviously, I'm no lawyer, but we use the same phrase, piercing the corporate veil. And in the UK, I understand that if you trade insolvently or if you cook the books in some form, that's obviously fraud anyway. But if you trade insolvently, you may become liable for personal, you know, liability. So that's something that you know, again, you need to talk to your accountant and just make sure you stay the right side of the law. So a small hint there, that's the end I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice. You can tell me what provisos I need to put on there. You know, all earnings are not typical. Okay. Next question from Josh. How do I go about registering my FBA business and getting a unique tax reference code? I think that's really a kind of accounting question, isn't it, really?
It is. Registering with Amazon, registering your brand is a fairly simple process. No brand registry. It's totally separate than getting your tax ID number in the U.S., which is called an EIN, which is also fairly simple. I don't know exactly when it comes to a foreign entity getting a U.S.-based tax ID number. But I don't know exactly what it is, but I know it's not terribly difficult.
No, well, having done it, I can say it's pretty straightforward. To be honest, I used a customs broker, and they just took care of it as part of my first import because I didn't want to have to deal with it, but it didn't seem to be a big deal. So, yeah, I would agree with that, having been in that situation. The next question is from Corby, who says, what's the cheapest way to protect my brand in the U.S. in general and on Amazon in particular? People are always worried about the fees associated with law, aren't they? As you said.
We're not, if you go to the right lawyer, you're not going to get beaten up on the fees. Okay? You're not going to get beaten up on the fees as long as you go to the right lawyer and the right law firm. Okay? Now, what does it cost? To do your trademark application, we charge $1,200 plus the filing fees, which is just under $300 per category. But again, when a client calls in and I talk to that client for free, okay, so don't be afraid to call when I talk to you for free. Then I'll be able to give you a better idea of what it's going to cost you. In terms of obtaining other protections, it really depends on the product itself. You really have to look at it on a product-by-product basis. There might be some products where you don't really need to file. You just need to do certain other things. What people used to do not that long ago is they had an idea. They would describe the idea. They'd write it down on a piece of paper, stick it in an envelope, send it to themselves, registered mail, and just keep it and never open it. So that later on, if there was a dispute as to who had the idea first, you could go to court with your sealed envelope with the postmark on it and say, no, I mailed this to myself in 1997.
Okay, interesting. And is that still effective now?
It's better than nothing.
Yeah, that sounds delightfully old school. I mean, really, I don't know if you can do the same thing in the UK. I mean, I'm really not sure. It's very interesting you said that the US has a use for or first use basis for their IP law. I really don't know if it's the same in the UK or not. I have no idea. But I guess I better talk to a UK lawyer. Shouldn't put you on the spot about English law. By the way, Americans listening, there is no such thing as UK law. Just to clarify, there's English law, and then there's the law in Wales. And Scotland has, and always has had, a completely separate legal system. Nobody's going to care about that distinction except Scots, but there's probably like four Scots listening right now. So guys, I'm looking out for you, because there's technically no such thing as UK law, just to let you guys know. So in case you were thinking of practicing law there, and we've finally got onto this, the rather epic question from Youssef. I'll try and simplify this down. It basically, the chapter and verse on some Amazon errors, as a catalogue of errors, really, that basically it comes down to that Amazon disposed of some of his units in error and has, quotes, refused to reimburse him. And just looking through this, they've disposed of most of his items. It sounds like he sent in a rather large number of shipments, about 25 separate shipments, which is probably rather confusing to Amazon. So I would advise anyone listening not to do that. But he had 25 variations on his product, which, again, unless you're really experienced, is probably a bit of a risk of confusion. And I think that's what happened. I think what happened is that some things got sent out to customers who complained that they received the wrong variation of the product. So to cut the long story short, they disposed of his products. And his argument was that they were unfulfilled for a month. So Amazon's argument was that the products were unfulfilled for over a month, so their disposal was automatic. However, the seller feels that he received written assurance by Amazon staff that the reason for the unfulfilled units was that they made a mistake with the bin check. So pretty involved. What's your sort of approach in a situation like this? Is probably the best way I can put this question.
It sounds like there's kind of one of two issues there. Either one, Amazon made these mistakes, which cost sales, which cost money. And the only way to really resolve, get the money back from Amazon in that particular scenario, is probably to take Amazon, to arbitration, or you can put in a case which may or may not work out. if you're an ongoing seller, you might shy away from anything that contradicts or creates any animosity between you and Amazon. I mean, should you get suspended or whatever, they own the entire planet. There's no other Amazon to go to. So I'd recognize that unless it's a significant amount of money, you may not want to go that route. There's also, and they haven't launched yet, it's a long-term client of mine, a fantastic seller, multi-million-dollar seller, who is starting a consulting company over the next 3 to 4 weeks, who's really going to focus on these types of issues of recouping funds that are due to you based upon errors within Amazon's system. I'm really not at liberty right now to provide the name and number and sort of stuff, but I expect them to launch another couple of weeks, and we'll provide it to you. We can provide it to your listeners. But I think it's really going to be something that's worthwhile to sellers to help them find money that's still on the table.
Dealing with Amazon making mistakes and owing you money, and again, it can be pretty serious. I know one person that he's got a business has been turning over several hundred thousand dollars a month for quite a time, and I think he's owed something like $150,000 in various forms of refunds that haven't made their way through the system and reimbursements, whatever. I think the key is, and the way it seems to be working for him, is to get somebody who really understands the Amazon back-end system, as it were, which is a rather unlovely phrase, but the Seller Central system, and can work with Amazon rather than take an adversarial approach. Because as you say, if you annoy Amazon, to put it politely, in case my lawyers are listening, then unfortunately there is no other Amazon.com on the planet which is can in any way come close as a place to sell products. And the other thing to say is that, you know, David and Goliath is one thing, but it's rather like a sort of two-inch-high Goliath, you know, David taking on a Goliath that's, you know, 500 feet tall. I mean, it's a bit of an unfair fight. So I would advise you, Yusuf, to not reach for the phone for lawyers immediately, but try and work within Amazon's system before you go too nuclear.
Also, what I really want people to recognize is that even though I am an attorney, we are not rushing to court. Our goal is to resolve issues. And after 20 years of trying cases and representing entrepreneurs and reaching agreements and knowing how to communicate with people in a way that makes them want to resolve things, like brand managers, they're not in the business of putting mom and pops out of business. Their job is to protect the brand. So they don't want the news getting out that they shut down, you know, someone in Nebraska. They want to protect their brand without any risk or harm. Most of the people who make these IP complaints, most suspensions can be resolved amicably. You know, we had a case the other day where we quoted the client like a $2,500 fee on an intellectual property issue, and another lawyer asked for $20,000 up front, but he was going to go right into litigation. And, you know, as you do this more and more, you know, I'm also a very friendly social guy. And so I know a lot of the lawyers who are on the other side on a first name basis. So you call up and you say, hey, Barry, how are you? How's the kid? I remember your son's about to graduate from college right now. How's that? And then you get into the case. And you say, listen, I've got a client who sold ABC product. Can we work this out? And most of them want to work it out because big companies don't want to hurt little guys. Big companies want to make money. The employees and the lawyers and the brand managers, their goal is to report to their boss that they got a goal accomplished, which is protecting their brand, not to hurt sellers. So just because I'm a lawyer doesn't mean you're in a fight. We have rarely, in terms of our Amazon clientele, okay, rarely even had to threaten court, let alone go to court. So I think everything requires the right person to address it. And, you know, we have the background in the education where we can tell them what the risks are in a way that's non-confrontational to get the sellers back to selling. That's always our goal. If you end up in court for year after year, you've already lost. You can't win. So we avoid litigation. We try and resolve things as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Makes total sense. As you said, I think that the truth is that the only people who win from litigation are the lawyers. And even then, as you said, if your objective is, you know, either because of who's hired you or because you work in-house, if your objective is protection, then really that's almost a failure in the sense that, you know, protection is about preventing things happening, as you said. And Yeah, I love your approach. It makes total sense. And I think the idea of being adversarial, whilst it could be, you know, such an attractive idea to all of us sometimes to give Amazon a bloody nose by giving them, you know, a bit of a punch, the truth is we're flies on an elephant. I don't think any of us could hurt Amazon, even if we, you know, all clubbed together. I mean, even all, you know, all the UK-based sellers that I know put together. So, yeah, I think it's good to be real about that stuff.
It's also, it's bad business. It's bad business to get into disputes. It's good business to resolve them quickly and get back to selling. And some resolutions are, they're just going to withdraw their complaint. Some resolutions are you sell out your inventory. Some resolutions are you negotiate a distribution agreement. Some resolutions are really just that they made the complaint inappropriately. You say, hey, listen, you made the complaint. We don't want anything from you, even though you're causing our client to lose $10,000 a week. We just want to get back to selling and getting business. And the other side, when they have made a mistake, they're relieved. And that's why we're on a first name basis with the lawyers at Amazon. Why we're on a first name basis with the lawyers for McGraw-Hill and Pearson and Apple and Samsung and Warner Brothers and a whole list of other companies that we've worked with, because the goal is simply to work out an agreement to get you guys back to selling and back on the platform doing what you do best, not fighting, not litigating.
Makes total sense. So that's a very refreshing thing. Many, many things about you, CJ, that are very refreshing. A lawyer that gives not only straight answers, but very clear and concise answers, and a lawyer who's not obsessed with litigating, and also sounds like the fees are very reasonable, and also you're prepared to talk to people without actually immediately billing them, which is very refreshing as well. So been fantastic stuff. So thank you so much for your time. I'm very, very grateful. I think that there's some really key issues that I've never heard addressed clearly that you've addressed very, very clearly. So this is great stuff. How can people find out more about your contact, UCJ, if they need to?
This is where I bring the movie screen down.
Yeah, please do. This is where you pitch them. I'm like, for $500, you... No, don't do that.
Okay. The website is AmazonSellersLawyer.com. Sellers is plural, lawyer is singular. AmazonSellersLawyer.com. My email address is CJ, the letter C, the letter J, at AmazonSellersLawyer, and I apologize for being so long. The same thing on Skype, the same thing on WeChat, AmazonSellersLawyer. We speak to every potential client, every caller, every person submits a chat. We're a free consultation, so first we can identify what the issue is and then let you know whether we think we can help you. I know the other non-lawyers who do plans of action charge you for a callback. I have very high, I think, moral and ethical obligations where I don't charge anything until I think I can help you. And that means speaking with you. Oftentimes when you call in or you write, I'll just kind of walk you through how you can help yourself, which is sometimes a better route to go. And what I've done my entire career, whether it was entrepreneurs, buying and selling brick and mortar businesses, all the way up through all my trial work and all the way up to today, is developed long-term relationships. I have the same clients from 20 years ago. And it's because I try and give them good advice for themselves, and I'm sure we'll do fine over the long haul. So AmazonSellersLawyer.com, and please don't be shy about calling. Because first we'll talk to you, but no charge, then give you what we think is a good roadmap for you.
Great. Well, I just want to second that the people I've spoken to have had the misfortune of having to deal with account suspension have indeed had to pay really large sums just to have a conversation with people sometimes. Like, we're talking $3,000 for a 30-minute, 60-minute call. So what you say is I can back up from experience. So very refreshing change again. We will be putting very detailed show notes up, folks, at www.amazingfba.com/CJ, because obviously there's a lot of detail and a lot of law is about detail. So Daniel is going to be working his fingers to the bone editing this together. But CJ, it just remains for me to say for now, many, many thanks for fantastic quality information and clearly put. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
If I could also add, it's really sad that my wife and four children can't join me. I really didn't invite them, but they can't join me. And I'm going to be in London for a day or so at the very end of the month. I think I arrive on the 31st, and I'm leaving April 2nd, and I'll be back in May establishing our London office. And I'm happy to talk or meet with groups of sellers if there's anything going on, or you buy me a pint and I'll talk your ear off.
Sounds like a great offer. Okay, well, look, I'll keep people posted with that. So I think the best thing is if I'll put some kind of sign-up form on the blog at amazingfba.com/CJ, and then anyone listening or watching who's interested, I'll send you an email update about where CJ is, and maybe we can engineer a meetup for a few people. That would be really cool. So thank you. We will take you up on that offer. You may have several pints to consume.
I'll do my best.
Great. CJ, thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Michael Veazey from Amazing FBA. I've got a quick one for you. If you're super stoked and awesomely excited to sell on Amazon, that's great. But if you're American, I'm afraid you need to stop listening because this one is for the Brits only. I'm not being biased, but this is because I'm talking about something which is based in London. So you're going to need to be in Britain or near Britain to take advantage of it. The basic problem we have as internet entrepreneurs is we are lonely and isolated because we're tapping, sadly, at our tablets on our own. We're cooped up with our computers and we're going insane with the internet. We need to connect to other people. It's only a human thing, right? And relationships are the basis of all good business. So if you are in that situation, keep listening because we have a solution called the Amazing FBA London Mastermind. But I'm going to specifically talk to you if you're in that situation, but you are yet to launch on Amazon. So you want to launch on Amazon, you haven't got there yet. This is exactly for you. It's called the Zero to Hero Pre-Launch Mastermind. And our aim is very simple, to get you from research or importing, or even if you've got products on the way to Amazon, to launch with your first product live on Amazon. That's our goal. That's our focus. How do we achieve that? Very simple. We have a face-to-face meeting of up to 15 people, no more than that. So it's very, very focused. And you get 30 minutes minimum to talk about your business and focus on the single issue that's blocking you that month to move you forward. The other way we keep you accountable is that we have a video accountability call once a month as well, which it goes in between the physical meetups so that we keep that momentum going, because momentum's everything, guys. As you know, on your own, you just lose the dream and you fall into slowness and then the business just dies from neglect. So we do the opposite. We keep it moving. We keep each other motivated. We inspire and we tell the truth about what doesn't work so other people can learn from it. We also have a couple of other things. I give an exclusive newsletter available only to members of the Mastermind where I share the latest tips, techniques, and tricks and bigger strategies that I'm trying on my Amazon businesses and tell you what works and frankly what doesn't work as well, so you can learn from my mistakes. And of course, there's an exclusive Facebook group to share all this good stuff with each other in between the meetings and the accountability calls. So there's a ton on offer here. It's obviously going to be very limited because it's maximum 15 people anyway, but for the first 5 people who come on board, there will be a special deal and a very special price for life. But that's obviously only for the first 5 people who come on board. So if you want to check it out, just go to amazingfba.com/London Mastermind and you can find out there more about it. You can apply there as well if you want to. And if you move fast, you might even be one of the lucky first 5 people to take advantage of it as well. So that's amazingfba.com/London Mastermind. I'm going to put this video out to everyone on my podcast and everyone in the Facebook group, of which we've got nearly 900 members now, and on the YouTube channel. So I imagine that this will fill quite quickly. So if you're serious about it, get yourself over to amazingfba.com/London Mastermind and you can find. Thanks for listening.